Moan Broadcast Center. This is Take 2. May Martinez. A coronavirus mutation in the UK has caused concern. We'll ask our expert for the facts on that and also get an answer as to why this latest infection surge in LA is coming on so strong. Plus, an urban planner with no political experience took down an LA City Council incumbent and set a record for getting the most votes ever. Meet Nithya Raman. It's all ahead on Take 2. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC and KPCC.org, this is Take 2. I'm Martinez. Thanks for being with us today. Coming up.
When people act kindly, receive kindness, or witness kindness, they're more inclined to be kind towards other individuals as well.
That's right. Kindness is contagious, and there's research to prove it. That's ahead. But first, to our health. So we got some good news at the end of last week that vaccines from Moderna and the National Institutes of Health have been approved for emergency use. The coronavirus case count in California remains stubbornly high. Earlier today, during Governor Gavin Newsom's press conference, officials reported more than 37,000 new cases, and the state's positivity rate is now at 12%. Think about this, it was 8.7% just a couple of weeks ago. So yeah, not a great increase. Here in Los Angeles County, more than 11,000 new cases were reported today. And grocery stores, for one, are reporting a spike in the number of their employees who have COVID-19. And also, to add to all that, news from officials in England and South Africa and elsewhere of a new variant strain of the virus. Here to make sense of all of this, we invite back Professor Paula Cannon. She's a virologist with the Keck School of Medicine at the University of Southern California. Professor Cannon, let's talk about the variants of the virus that are being reported. What exactly did British officials share this weekend?
Sure. So they reported that they'd identified a variant with a catchy name, B.1.1.7, that looked like it was really spreading at a faster rate throughout London and the south of England. And specifically that this variant had gone from being sort of first noticed at the end of September to now being the strain of the virus that they were pulling out of about 60% of all new infections in that part of the country. And, you know, while you're going to definitely get slight variations in this virus from person to person or in different regions or countries, this particular British variant kind of got everybody's attention because it had, I think, 17 sort of specific differences than the sort of regular strains we see, which is a lot more than you normally, you know, get in one package of one virus. And this kind of rapid rise in the percentage of infections that had this particular strain really indicates that it could, and it's a big could, have new properties that are making it more infectious and easier to spread between people.
Okay, that's not great news there. What's the situation in South Africa as well and some of these other countries?
Sure. So South Africa have independently also noticed that they've got a new sort of variant that is spreading. And it's got some, although not all, of the changes that they're seeing in this new British variant. So there could be sort of overlap there, or it could just be, you know, kind of random chance. And then this new British strain has also been seen, I think, in the Netherlands and Australia as well. So if you like, the horse is already out of the barn. Yeah. In terms of spread.
Now, as far as here in California, Governor Newsom today said there is no evidence of this strain yet in California, in the state here. However, he says the state has been having conversations with airlines and stakeholders about possible quarantine protocols for UK visitors. Here's California Health Secretary Dr. Mark Galli describing the new strain as more sticky.
An exposure to somebody with the new strain may mean you're more likely to get infected than if you were exposed to the current strain. And that is why we're worried. We haven't yet seen what we call increased virulence, meaning that people necessarily get sicker with this new strain, but the fact that it infects more easily, it seems, is what we are worried about.
Professor, the new strain, variant, the words mutation, they sound terrifying, but can you put this into context for us? How concerned should we be?
Sure. And, you know, after a lifetime of watching Hollywood movies, we all know that, virus mutation has got to be bad. But
they have done a number on our psyche, Professor. You know,
indeed.
That.
Yeah. So, you know, the first thing to recognize is that many viruses mutate and they do it all the time. And a lot of these mutations have no impact. It's just background noise. And then sometimes you get a specific mutation that just becomes more widespread, and it's just random chance. And it looks scary, but it's really just, you know, probability and chance. But then you do get some viruses that mutate and adapt, and they adapt to be a better fit for their human host. And ironically, if you think about it, if you're a virus, the way you would really like to evolve is you'd like to kind of become less lethal. You'd like to be more infectious, but not make your host sick. You know, you want your host to go out shopping and go to restaurants, not be lying sick in bed. So the idea of mutations making a virus that is more virulent kind of is not what we would expect. But it could be that there are new strains that are just a little better at hopping from person to person.
You mentioned something, and I hate to bring this up, Professor, but you know, we mentioned Hollywood, that movie Outbreak, the one with Dustin Hoffman a few years ago, but there was a scene in there where an Ebola outbreak kind of killed everyone in sight. So the Ebola virus itself was gone because there was no host left to infect.
And, you know, a little bit like the first SARS virus, you know, that was very lethal, you know, killed, you know, 25% of people who got it. But because it was sort of so bad and everybody who got it had really bad symptoms, it was really easy to identify who had it, isolate those people. And really, I think only something like 7,000 people total worldwide got SARS-1, easy to sort of handle. So the problem with SARS-2, the one we have currently, is that it is a milder virus in many people, and that's why it is spreading more.
But then, you know, I read headlines, let's say in the Daily Mail in the UK, I read this headline that the new COVID strain will become, quote, dominant global strain. I mean, how do we make sense of comments like that? Because that I know what those headlines are there for, Professor. I realize that. But a lot of people don't. A lot of people look at that and are terrified.
Yeah. What can I say? Don't get your science news from the Daily Mail, much as I like the entertainment news. So, again, you know, it is possible to have strains that spread more frequently, but it doesn't necessarily mean that we're going to do anything different. You know, we know how to protect ourselves from this virus. And so even if we have a strain that is slightly more infectious, and remember, that's still a big if, the practices we're currently recommending, staying distant from people, wear a mask, don't mix with people, that's going to work against any strain of this virus or any new tricks it might want to throw at us.
When these changes happen, these new strains happen, I mean, how do health officials across the globe keep track of the changes and to keep everyone updated?
Sure. So there's a lot of work goes into this and some very sophisticated science. It's called sequencing the viral genomes. And, you know, viruses are a little bit different person to person. It's almost like they have sort of fingerprints. Mm-hmm. And actually, public health, personnel use these sort of fingerprint differences to identify what might have been a source of a viral outbreak, you know, a sort of, if there's a super spreader event. So there's a lot of work goes into this. And especially, I have to say, in the United Kingdom, they really are sort of leading the world in terms of getting into the weeds of these viruses. Mm. So it's probably not surprising that, you know, they identified this new strain just because they look really hard.
Another thing on this, because, I, you know, thinking about the latest surge in Los Angeles right now, it feels very, very bad. Is there any way to know what strain of the virus we're dealing with here in L.A., in California? And might it be different from what hit us back in the spring or summer?
Sure. So we've got a real mixture of viruses here, just like, you know, any sort of major city in the world. And to my knowledge, there's no reports yet of this specific new British strain. But instead, we do really have a mixture. But, you know, unfortunately, I don't think LA can blame our latest, depressing numbers of viral infections on a virus variant. It's basically down to our human behavior.
Because I remember early on when the governor of New York was talking about what was hitting New York, that was from Italy, he would say. Mm-hmm. And so there was an Italian strain. And then we didn't work clear exactly what was going on in California. So I'm wondering if all that has been broken down.
Yeah, it's also murky. You know, early on when there were very few sources of the virus, you could kind of say, yes, this came from Italy. Now it's just the whole world is just this sort of melting pot of all these different strains.
So then the next thing, Professor, will be the vaccine. So how effective is the vaccine that's being spread right now against the new strains of the virus as they develop?
Yeah, so there's good news here. So, okay, a little bit of background. If you remember the Pfizer and Moderna RNA vaccines and also the AstraZeneca vaccine that's probably going to come online early in the new year, These all just have different ways of getting the virus spike protein, which is the blob on the outside, into your body so that your immune system sees the spike protein as foreign and makes things like antibodies that are custom made to stick to the spike protein and neutralize the virus. And the good news is that when we make antibodies, we make them as like a swarm, and they attach at all different parts of the spike protein. So even if you get a new variant that's a little bit tweaked, a little bit changed in one bit of the spike protein, so that, say, one of your antibodies no longer sticks to it, well, it's no big deal because the vaccine and your immune system have made many different antibodies. You know, it's got like a backup plan, wow, and all the rest of them will still work. So a virus would have to be very, very different to get around the immunity that these vaccines are going to give us. And I really don't think that's likely to happen.
So we won't need an update. Like, say, like measles, you get one vaccine and it's over with. We won't maybe need an update on this vaccine, say, years down the road.
We're not anticipating it. But again, the good news is that if we do, if we start to see, for example, that vaccinated people are getting infected with the new strain, then it's going to be relatively easy to take the spike protein from that new variant of the virus and just put it in the vaccine, and you get like a top-up vaccine to cope with that as well.
We're talking to USC professor of virology, Paula Cannon. All right, moving on now. As mentioned, this current surge of the virus in LA County is the roughest so far. Professor, would you say LA County is like the epicenter for California when it comes to this? I mean, are we like New York was back in the spring? I remember the governor of New York called it the epicenter of the coronavirus pandemic.
Yeah, it's like everybody's taking their turn in the U.S. at the moment, yeah, isn't it? And it's definitely our turn in Southern California. It's not just L.A. County. You know, Riverside, San Bernardino, all of our Southern California counties are looking bad. And, of course, L.A. County we're especially concerned about just because we're so big. We have so many people. You know, we've got very high rates. I was looking at the numbers, you know, the past 7 days, we've probably had 98,000 people have been reported as infected. And I was doing the math, and that's basically about 1% of LA County's total population. So, you know, think about that. They're the cases we know about. It's really high levels out there right now, and people should just be aware of that as they're kind of, you know, walking around or even, you know, going into a grocery store. You know, there's a lot of the coronavirus out there.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, we started to lock down again right before Thanksgiving. Granted, not as strict as before, but strict enough, but it doesn't seem to be making much of a dent. Why do you think that is?
I think we're just not great at it anymore. You know, many people don't even seem to realize we're under lockdown, and we're also tired of it. And then, yeah, of course, the virus is everywhere, so it's really difficult to avoid it. But I hope I can reset everybody's brain a little bit. You know, I'm not a scaremonger, but I just want people to realize it's at really high levels out there everywhere at the moment. So this is the time to maybe be a little more fearful and a little more careful and you know, limit going out and be very conscious about wearing a mask and keeping your distance from people.
Yeah, and you're right about everyone just being 100% tired of this. I live very close to a restaurant that is infamous right now for flouting any convention when it comes to what they should be doing, what they shouldn't be doing. It's really strange to drive past it and to see everyone so openly happy at being right next to each other in a restaurant with no masks, yeah, and you know, yelling, screaming up and down.
I want to cry when I see that. I mean, you know, obviously I work in a medical school. I have friends who are working in the hospitals, and I see what they're going through. And I've lost friends now to this virus, and I don't know how you can, you know, take off a mask and sit there and eat like it's, you know, it's nothing to do with your behavior. People, it is right now. It really is.
Now, you mentioned earlier the grocery stores. What is the risk level? I mean, people have to go to the market. I mean, I guess you can order stuff online and have it delivered, put on your porch, and then you pick it up. But, you know, I think for the most part, most people go to the store to get the stuff they need. What is that risk level right now, would you say?
Sure. So again, you know, we've seen reports lately that, you know, more and more grocery store employees are getting coronavirus as well. And, you know, that's obviously very concerning for them. So I think just, you know, think about how you go to the grocery store. You know, if you normally go 2-3 times a week, go once a week. I always say this, but be fast, be efficient. Imagine you have a toddler with you having a temper tantrum. You don't need to sort of peruse which particular, you know, produce you want. Just go in and grab stuff, get out. And while you're there, be respectful, stay alert, you know looking at your cell phone, be respectful of other people. There's nothing worse, I think, than when you see people just kind of wandering around looking at their phone and they kind of bump into you. And then you spend your whole time in the grocery store kind of like leaping out of the way of people who are distracted. So there's ways to go shopping where we can be more aware and more respectful.
Or a traffic jam in an aisle with car and people. I'm like, what? I want to get something. I can't get it because there's three grocery carts and people sitting there. Yeah, it's mm-hmm. not so easy. Wondering, for people that have grandparents or parents in their life that are, say, 75 and over, should they right now, at least for the time being, go get their groceries if they can?
Oh, my gosh, yes. I think that's a great idea. I mean, you know, especially at this time of year, you know, when our instincts are to reach out and help people, if you have a relative or a neighbor who's older and therefore in that much higher risk group, you know, what a nice thing to say to them. You know, I've got to go to the grocery store. Give me your list. I'll do it for both of us as well. And please don't judge my choice of, you know, oranges.
Yeah, but still have that target, right? Make sure that you are targeted and focused on what you're getting and what you're getting for the people
Indeed.
That you're buying it for. Yeah. Well, one more thing, Professor. You know, Leslie, I mentioned the good news about the Moderna vaccine and the vaccine from NIH being approved. Mm-hmm. How does that fortify our arsenal going forward in 2021?
So this is the silver lining. This is just still such great news. And not just these vaccines are approved, but they're actually getting into people. I love seeing my friends. Again, I said, I work in a medical center. And so our colleagues in the hospitals at USC are getting vaccinated. And I feel I exhale a little bit every time I see one of them posted on social media that they got vaccinated. And more are going to come online. You know, we've just heard that the AstraZeneca Oxford University vaccine is likely to be approved in the new year, at least in the UK. And I would expect that may get approved over here as well. So we're going to have more vaccines and more opportunities for people to get vaccinated.
Just don't read any headlines from the UK. That's what you got to do.
Yeah.
Why do you guys do that?
Only about, you know, sort of Meghan and Harry.
That's really okay. That's okay. That's USC professor of virology, Paula Cannon. Paula, thank you very much. Enjoy your holiday. Have a happy new year if we don't speak to you before then.
You too. I take care.
An LA City Council incumbent has not lost a re-election bid in 17 years until last month. An urban planner with no past political experience not only beat the incumbent in District 4, she also set a record for the most votes in an LA City Council race ever, over 70,000. Meet Nithya Raman. She's next when Take 2 continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and streaming on the KPCC app. I'm E. Martinez. Before the March primary, in her run for city council, Nithya Raman said her campaign volunteers must have knocked on over 70,000 doors in LA's District 4. Now, remember that number, 70,000. District 4 is a huge area that spans from Sherman Oaks to Hancock Park to Silver Lake, but she kind of needed to lean into the ground game because Raman was taking on an incumbent, David Rue, and in LA, city council incumbents rarely lose. Raman forced the runoff, then in November wound up beating Rue by more than doubling her showing in the primary, and she nabbed a record number of votes. Yeah, remember that number? 70,000. That's the amount of votes she got. That's as grassroots as an effort gets. And on her first day as a city council member, a little less than a week ago, she introduced a pair of motions to tackle one of her core campaign issues, homelessness. Nithya Raman, welcome to Take Two.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, before we get to the motions you announced, I'd like to take a quick look back at how you even got here. So your homelessness platform seemed to be what District 4 voters connected to the most. What specific thing about it do you think resonated?
Well, I talked about how we could do better on addressing homelessness. I talked about how we could provide services more effectively. I talked about how we could create and build the kind of housing that we need for people experiencing homelessness more quickly and more cheaply, ideally, than we are doing it right now. I talked about ways to prevent people who are currently in housing from falling into homelessness. And I think the thing that resonated with voters was this idea that we could do better.
All right, now to your two motions, both on homelessness. The first is to establish a drop-in service center somewhere in your district. First off, what is that and why do you think it's needed?
You know, when I was doing work in my own neighborhood, which is Silver Lake, we went out to encampments, got to know people, and we saw that there was no place where people who were experiencing homelessness, or just as importantly, people on the verge of homelessness, could go to get the help that they needed in order to actually get back into a home, or to speak to a case manager, or even really to use a bathroom, or to take a shower, or to receive mail. And so this idea of having a place where people are welcomed and where they can talk to folks who can help them, I think that is a really, really important tool in moving us further along in addressing this crisis.
And right now, there are no plans for one in District 4, right? I mean, well, as of you taking over.
No, okay. Not a drop-in center. Although this kind of model, it's called a navigation center, according to the city. They have actually built one in District 2, and there's plans to build two more. And it is part of the broader policy thinking that the city has had. We just haven't moved forward on it very quickly.
Okay, because here's one of the things. The boundaries of District 4 are as twisty as I've ever seen. I mean, Sherman Oaks, Coldwater Canyon, Hollywood, up to Toluca Lake, down to Larchmont, Miracle Mile, then back up to Los Feliz, Griffith Park, Silver Lake. If your district is only going to have one, how do you decide where the best place for it is?
I think you could find a place where the need is very urgent and prioritize putting it there as the first option. But I also think that you need to be looking across the district, exactly as you said, and find locations for these in every neighborhood. And I think they all don't have to look the same. It could be a lobby of a church that's not being used every day and that functions as a drop-in center. And it could have one, or it could have many of the kinds of services that people need. I think the point is that we need more of them, and that I think that we can get more of them to neighborhoods, to people who need them.
Now, the other part of that first motion were about funding options. But council member, with the city just trying to stay solvent right now, how do you expect the city to provide any funding for drop-in centers anywhere?
Well, there are actually funding sources available that are earmarked for homelessness already. These are funding sources that I think you could lay claim to and say that this is part of the solution there. I don't think we would need more money. We would just need to be using the money that we're already using for homeless services in ways that really serve the needs of neighborhoods.
Now, the past few election cycles, voters have indicated a willingness to put their votes and tax dollars toward homelessness. For example, 2016, HHH authorized the city $1.2 billion to partially subsidize 10,000 housing units. It took 3 years, though, before anyone saw anything built. That was in January of this year, and then the world came to a screeching halt. Wondering, council member, has the management of HHH's funds failed Angelenos?
I think the kinds of housing units that were planned to be built under HHH, permanent supportive housing units, and the way in which that program was structured, it was always going to be a long process. And the thing I want to say is that we don't need just permanent supportive housing units. We need all kinds of shelter options and housing options. We need a whole range. And I think trying to find ways to make sure that range of options is available and comes online, I think that is really part of the challenge going forward. Things like rehabbing multi-unit buildings or motels or homes where people can live in shared accommodation. These are all things that we need to be thinking about right now.
Can any HHH money be clawed back somehow, maybe be used with more urgency? Because, council member, I think a lot of people, as I mentioned before, that were willing to vote for and approve measures that go toward homelessness, they weren't expecting to wait as long as they've been waiting for not a lot of progress to be made.
That's a real concern for the city, for sure. What we saw in HHH, what we saw in Measure H, was, however, a real willingness to spend more to take on this crisis. And I do think that this is a real danger, that if residents lose faith that the government is able to make progress, they will be less inclined to support these kinds of increases in the future. I will say that I don't think we are there yet. I think that in my election, what I saw among voters, what I saw among residents, was a real willingness to do more. that is the work of the future right now. And I'm really excited about getting to it.
We're talking with Los Angeles City Councilmember Nithya Raman. Now, your second motion had to do with LASA, the Los Angeles Homeless Services Authority. What do you propose happens with LASA?
It was really to understand what one of the functions that LASA provides to the city of Los Angeles, which is directly providing and contracting out to provide outreach services for people who are experiencing homelessness. It was a motion to really understand how outreach is being provided. In line with the drop-in center idea and the idea that people who are experiencing homelessness need repeated, consistent contacts with case managers, with outreach workers, with trained mental health caseworkers, I wanted to understand, we have a huge amount of money being spent towards outreach. How is that being spent?
In your motion, you mentioned how the agency has not been set up for success and no less than a systemic change is needed to better leverage their efforts. What did you mean by that?
We have asked LASA to be reactive in so many ways. In the past, when the city has spent dollars on outreach, a lot of that outreach money was being spent on ensuring that outreach workers were present at encampment cleanups. And so this was a process that yielded interactions between outreach workers and encampments that were happened in the presence of sanitation workers who were often asking people who were experiencing homelessness to throw out their things. They were happening often in the presence of armed law enforcement. These were not interactions that were designed to create relationships of trust, that were designed to help people who were experiencing homelessness access the services that they needed. I would really like to change the way in which that interaction happens. And I do think it's very possible.
LASA's been around for 27 years. I mean, how is it possible that a $400 million agency has gotten to a point where maybe an evaluation or a reset is being suggested?
LASA has changed a lot. It's taken on a lot more money. It's taken on a lot more responsibility, especially since homelessness has been rising across the city and across the county. And so I think this is a good moment to ask, okay, how are we spending our dollars and how are we interacting with LASA? I really think that these interactions can be made much more effective. We just need to make sure that we are being thoughtful about how those interactions are happening.
The city council has a lot more power than the mayor does on the issue of homelessness. But I'm wondering, council member, how would you assess what Eric Garcetti has done so far on this?
You know, I think in so many ways, our homeless services system and our response to homelessness has been one step behind. And I don't think that's unique to Mayor Garcetti or the council. I think it's system wide. I think slowly we're ramping up to that. I see that, for example, in the fact that homelessness was central to the motions that Councilmember De Leon proposed on his first day, and Councilmember Mark Ridley-Thomas proposed on his first day, which was mine as well. I think it is central to the council now and to the mayor's office now, and I feel like now is a moment where there is an incredible amount of momentum from all of the council members to do more and to take on more.
I realize, Councilmember, you were just sworn in, but as you know, the clean slate that you have will not last long, especially on homelessness, not in this city. You're an urban planner. You've been a consultant and an activist. You moved here 6 years ago. That's when homelessness really exploded in Los Angeles. But that also means that you have not been a part of the entrenched LA political machine. So beyond the 70,000 people that voted for you, what do you say to the other 4 million Angelenos that really have had enough with politicians making declarations that homelessness is the moral crisis of our time, then not fixing it?
You know, I think a little bit of this is that we have to do better as a city in bringing people into the solution and enabling them to see what the path is towards getting to the end of this moment of crisis. And I think we can do a lot better as elected officials in telling that story and in bringing people in. I understand the deep cynicism that so many residents feel about our city's ability to really take on and address homelessness. And yet I just came off of a campaign where I was able to really experience the hope and the passion that people have to address this crisis. And I think there is an incredible amount of energy to take it on in Los Angeles. And I think our role as elected representatives right now is to tell our 4 million residents here, what is their role? How can they do it? And to enable them to be part of that solution.
That's Nithya Raman, who represents the city of Los Angeles' 4th District. Councilmember, thank you very much.
Thank you so much for having me.
There can be a disconnect when we hear stats and numbers about how COVID-19 is affecting hospitals, so we've been putting a face and a voice to those numbers. Coming up next, the person who helps people breathe by connecting them to ventilators, then disconnects them when they get better, and also when they don't. Her story is next when Take 2 continues. Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC and on the KPCC app. I'm A. Martinez. We've talked today about how high the COVID-19 case count is here in L.A. County. And as the pandemic continues to stretch on, ICU bed capacities have plummeted. Southern California is still at 0%, and this is testing frontline workers in an entirely new way. In an effort to better understand what hospital workers and first responders are going through, we've been bringing you some of their stories. Now, up next is Dawn Reifmeyer, a respiratory care practitioner at Pomona Valley Hospital. Her job, connecting, treating, and disconnecting patients from ventilators, a task that has really become unbearable as case counts climb higher every day.
I don't think anybody was prepared for what happened. The only thing I could equate it to is like a soldier going into battle. I have seen the anguish. I work with these people. I see them more than my own family, and it is taking its toll. You know, the other day I was working, and I could see the patient was trying to say something, and I got close, and he said, "Will you just hold my hand and pray with me?" And so I did. And we have to be the strong ones. We have to be the professional ones. But it tears me up because I've been helping this person and this is not the result that I wanted. We all get into this profession to save lives and we're not able to save the lives. And it's really tragic. It's really difficult. It affects us. And to say it doesn't affect us would not be the truth. I think the reality that hit home for me is when we had whole families, the complete family on our units. When I saw that, I took note because I'm a parent. Many people are parents. I would never want my children in the hospital, and I don't think any parent would want that. There's a lot of guilt that because, usually I'll ask them, like, what were you doing? And they're like, oh, we had a barbecue. We were all together. And now they're all in the ICU. So I think for me, that was the reality. That's when I realized, okay, this is a bigger problem. So I have my faith, and that has really, really helped me through this. And I pray before I go to work, and I've had patients, they ask me to pray with them, and I pray with them. They're scared. A lot of my colleagues are scared. This is a very difficult time, and we don't have all the answers. We get close to these patients, and then some of them we lose, and it's very hard. And pre-COVID, you might lose one patient a month, and it was very sad. But we're losing 4 to 5 a week, and that's tragic. That's a tragedy, and it's taking its toll. And to say it doesn't affect you, if you weren't a compassionate and you didn't have empathy, you shouldn't be in this field. So I have my faith. I'm extremely worried, like, for the healthcare professionals out there. I don't think anybody is paying attention to what this is doing mentally, physically, emotionally. Nobody's talking about that, and that's my concern. Like, at the end of the day, let's take care of the ones that care for the sick. You know, I have colleagues and they have little ones, and when they go home after 12 hours, now they have to be teacher, mom, wife, and it's too much. And I'm really concerned. And after we're through this, we really have to make sure, because these people are maxed out on what they can handle. It is enough to come in and do this job in a regular scenario, but then now you're adding all the other things on top of it, and it's too much.
That's Dawn Reithmeyer, a respiratory care practitioner at Pomona Valley Hospital. The stress is not only being felt in hospitals. Coronavirus outbreaks at childcare facilities in LA County are ticking up as the surge in cases continues. While the number of cases is relatively small, concerns are rising among parents and providers. KPCC's Mariana Dale reports.
There are more than 7,000 licensed childcare homes and centers open in LA. As of last week, 22 of them had reported an ongoing coronavirus outbreak of three or more cases. Here's Public Health Director Barbara Ferrer.
I want to give a lot of credit to all of our providers, our childcare providers. They've done an amazing job for many, many months taking care of small children, young children, using a lot of safety, and there have been very, very few cases.
In fact, prior to the recent surge, there had been only 18 outbreaks reported at childcare facilities in all of LA County since June. But the impact of even a single case ripples out from the provider to the families they care for. In the San Fernando Valley, Edna Fuentes says she was laid off from her supermarket job when her children's daycare closed after a teacher tested positive for COVID-19.
It's overwhelming. How can I provide for my kids right now?
South Los Angeles family child care provider Michaela Walker and her mother were recently exposed to a positive case and had to temporarily shut their doors.
It's like a gamble with our lives, too, to be quite honest. And it's just kind of hard because we also want to make sure that the children, though, have a safe and stable place.
Walker and her mom have since tested negative for the virus and are waiting for their families to do the same before they can reopen. Covering early childhood, I'm Mariana Dale.
How easy is it to be kind? Well, it seems as it would be no problem at all, but we are living in a strange, trying time. And even being kind can require an energy that really we're all short of these days. Coming up, a research-based case to being as kind as you can for as long as you can. That's next when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us.
Thanks to you for everything that love could bring.
Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC and on Apple Podcasts. I'm Amy Martinez. The holiday season is a time for giving and generosity. But did you know that research shows that kindness in all of its forms can have widespread effects? Joining us to discuss that is Professor Dan Fessler. He's the director of the Bedari Kindness Institute at UCLA. Professor, so how do you define kindness?
So there are many definitions. The way that we approach it at the Bedari Kindness Institute is we think about kindness as actions which are intended to benefit another person or group of people, where the other person is an end in themselves. That is, the goal is just to help them, not to achieve some ulterior motive by helping them.
being kind to yourself, is that something that applies to? Because some people would think that being kind to yourself is adds a little selfishness to it because you're not being kind to others.
Well, it turns out that many of the same psychological processes that are involved in being kind to others also play an important role in being kind to yourself, and that many of the physical benefits of being kind to others, the health consequences, also apply to being kind to yourself. So it looks like these things are not as different as they might seem.
You know, Professor, my grandpa used to say that, he said it in Spanish, so it sounds nicer in Spanish, but I'll just do it in English. But he used to say kindness is a bond, because when you perform some kind of kindness on someone else, you've created this bond that would last a long time, because when that person reflects on the kindness, you think about each other. You have this bond that really never goes away. So I'm wondering, generally, how do acts of kindness impact the recipient?
Well, positive actions towards others make us feel connected to those. And that in turn actually makes us, we think, more optimistic about future social interactions. The same kind of experience of becoming more optimistic about other people holds whether one is a witness to acts of kindness, the person being kind, or the person benefiting from that kindness. All of these experiences are connected. And while it's certainly true that receiving kindness from someone builds a bond between individuals, importantly, the effects of kindness aren't limited to that dyadic one-to-one relationship. So that when people either act kindly, receive kindness, or witness kindness, they're more inclined to be kind towards other individuals as well. So it's not just you're grateful to the person who's helped you and you want to reciprocate. Certainly that happens. But it's also that you become kinder towards others. So people sort of pay it forward. There's a knock-on effect. And the result can be that one act of kindness can ramify outward into an entire community.
So make it contagious in a way. You witness an act of kindness, you think that's really nice. I want to do that for someone else. I want to find someone else to be kind to.
Exactly. Kindness is contagious. And in fact, our research group has demonstrated this. We're just observing as a third party, individuals being kind to others makes people more altruistic. And it's not because they're concerned about what others will think of them. That is, it's not some strategic or Machiavellian ploy. Just witnessing anonymous strangers who you don't know anything about helping one another makes people inspired to help others themselves. And for that, there doesn't have to be any existing relationship or even know the identity of the benefactor or the beneficiary.
Because I was wondering, Professor, are there any negative effects toward maybe passing on an opportunity to be kind? So in other words, you're not hurting someone else. You're just not taking an opportunity to be kind when an opportunity presents itself.
Well, certainly, I think when people reflect back on important events in their lives, regret is a terrible emotion to live with. And missing an opportunity to help someone, particularly someone in dire need, is something that I think people often regret for the rest of their lives. So not only are there many positive benefits to seizing the opportunity to help others, there are costs to refraining from doing so.
Talking to Dan Fessler, director of the Bedari Kindness Institute at UCLA. Generally, what are barriers to kindness in our society right now?
So unfortunately, we live in a very unkind time. But despite that, there are remarkable acts of kindness going on all the time. So we can ask what leads individuals to be kind or to be unkind. And specifically, there are several things. First of all, dividing the world up into our group and their group, whatever those groups consist of, whether they're political parties, ethnic groups, religious groups, nation states, this is a barrier to kindness because people tend to dehumanize those whom they see as outside of their group, particularly if they construe the situation as a winner-take-all contest. And it's very, very difficult to empathize with, to appreciate the perspective and needs of someone who one sees as an other in this way. But that's not the only problem. The problem also is that people are inspired to be kind when they expect others to be kind also. That is, when they're optimistic about the level of cooperation in their community, in their society, and in humanity at large. When they're pessimistic about that, when they're more cynical about other people in this regard, then it's very difficult for them to experience those uplifting motivations to be kind. So it's possible to have both positive feedback that spirals upward, where a kind act inspires other kind acts, this changes people's expectations of kindness, but it can also go downward. If you're pessimistic about other people's tendency to be kind, you don't act kind yourself, and your own self-interested behavior then leads others to become more pessimistic and to themselves become more self-interested.
Dan, what can we all do to make a kinder world?
Well, obviously, during the current public health crisis, it's really important that the first act of kindness that people can do is to restrict their interactions in face-to-face situations so that they don't harm anyone inadvertently by transmitting coronavirus. But fortunately, we also live in a technological age where it's possible to be kind at a distance. I think people can examine their own resources, whether those resources are financial, personal, what skills people have, and look for ways to help others. And importantly, look for ways that really shape people's experiences in the moment, where they understand that the goal here is simply to help.
You know, I was thinking what you just said, Professor. Wearing a mask is an act of kindness, isn't it? I mean, you are being kind to other people by putting yourself in a position where hopefully you don't hurt others.
Absolutely. And one of the things that's very difficult for all of us to sort of grasp at an intuitive level is that we can be sick and not feel sick. That is, that we may be carrying this virus and transmit it to other individuals and yet feel fine ourselves. So the motivation to wear a mask, although masks do protect the wearer, importantly, the motivation really, really should be an altruistic one. That is, I don't think that anyone, if we think back to spring break, you know, in Florida, if we think back to Thanksgiving, I don't think that any of the people participating in large social gatherings would, you know, intentionally run over an elderly person in their car, right? That is, none of those people are bad people who are trying to hurt others. It's just that they don't realize that their actions may, in fact, endanger the lives of innocent third parties. So wearing a mask is an act of kindness. And keeping your distance from others and not getting together with family members over the holidays, those are acts of kindness.
Remember when we used to drop off, I don't know how old you are, Dan, but remember when we used to drop off videotapes at the video store and there was a sign that said, be kind,
be
rewind?
Be kind.
Right?
Yes,
I mean, be kind, wear a mask. That seems to be the new way we can use that phrase. Dan, given this time that we're in right now, when so many people are in need, others, though, have not been as negatively affected. Can you tell us why, maybe now more than ever, it's so important to think about being kind whenever you get the opportunity?
Well, a lot of people are suffering, and there are many, many consequences that we'll see play out in the future of the current pandemic. And the silver lining that is one possible outcome of these events is that people experience one another as kind. That is, that some of the divisions that have rendered our society in so many different dimensions start to be bridged simply by understanding that other people are decent human beings who care about one another. And if we emerge from the pandemic with a more optimistic view of others in our community and our society and around the planet, then the result of that ultimately will be a rising tide that lifts all boats. We'll all be better off.
That's Dan Fessler, director of the Bedari Kindness Institute at UCLA. Dan, thanks a lot.
Thank you. Be safe and be kind, everyone.
All right, I got a few more things for you to put on your kindness to-do list. Head on over to wherever you get your podcasts and download Take Two. That's one way to be kind. You could also follow us on Twitter at Take Two. That's a second way. And then the third way, why don't you follow your old pal, A. Martinez. A. Martinez, L.A., A. Martinez, L.A. Talk to you tomorrow at 2.